This is no ordinary sighting of an unidentified flying object. These pictures, taken over a six-month period in Gulf Breeze, Florida, are the most spectacular evidence of UFOs ever gathered. While some say the photos are fakes, that would not explain the fact that more than 20 people have reported seeing these objects on the very same nights.
No sound. There was no veering. It was a straight course. Halfway out over the bay, and I'd never seen anything like that. There were portholes. We saw portholes of light coming out of the portholes.
The man who took these pictures insists on remaining anonymous, so we'll call him Jim. We had a narrator read a transcript of our interview. Jim says his most threatening encounter with the UFOs occurred on this road. He says an object swooped over his car and sent out a beam of light.
And it came through the windshield, hit my exposed arms, and turned my skin to like it was asleep, but even worse. And then you don't have any feeling at all. I proceeded to panic.
Forced off the road, Jim fumbled with the camera, managing to snap this one dramatic picture. A noted optical physicist calculated the object was hovering about 3 feet off the ground. Photography experts say such a picture would be virtually impossible to fake.
Shooting out of the windshield of the car, through the windshield of the car, and being able to reproduce this object down the road, reflecting on the surface of the road, I feel would be very difficult to do.
But not everyone buys that argument. The mayor of Gulf Breeze is convinced the UFO reports are an elaborate hoax that are damaging to the image of his city.
I want to go on record as the mayor and express to all the population viewing this telecast.
Hey, all you lads and ladies, welcome back to your favorite podcast, That Would Be Rad, the podcast that majors in 80s and 90s nostalgia, comic culture, all things paranormal, and minors in retro video games, tabletop RPGs, pre-internet mysteries, manga, and raising our kids to be half as cool as we were back in the 80s. I'm your host, Tyler Bentz, and this is your other host,
Woody Brown.
Hey, pal.
Hey, man.
Summer's almost here, huh?
Dude, I was just about to say that, man. I can't, look, I do have a feeling like I say, you know, with every season of the year,
oh, yeah.
I'm always like, man, this is my favorite time of year. Mm-hmm. I think we just enjoy life, man.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I love the fall. I love this. I don't really, there's elements of spring that I love. It starts, you know, kind of, but for the most part, because of the pollen and all that crap.
Yeah, it's rough.
I hate.
Yeah, same.
But for some reason, and I was just talking to Ann about this, this summer, I don't know, man. I'm extremely excited. Maybe it's because it's like a little more mild than usual temperature-wise right now.
Dude,
here.
The temperature's pretty awesome.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
It feels kind of more like old school, hey, summer's about to begin weather here.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, pre, like, chemtrails.
Yeah, okay.
That's really...
Boy, any chance he gets.
Conspiracy corner. Hey, and the reason I bring up summer, let me just reiterate here. The actual first day of summer...
Here we go.
...is surprisingly my birthday, June 21st. So if anybody would like to send gifts, chocolates...
There's no... I don't have anywhere to send it.
Not caramel corn. What is it called?
Cracker Jacks?
No, it's like the
Fiddle Faddle?
Well, it's kind of like Fiddle Faddle. It's the type of corn. Why can't I think of the name?
Popcorn, dude. Are you kidding me? Please don't tell me that.
Candy corn. The kind that's... Huh?
I don't know, man.
Wait, what'd you just say?
Candy corn. That's not even in the realm of possibility.
No, I know it's not. But I'm thinking of like the... It's a type of corn that comes in the little tins. You know, you have like the three separated.
Oh, yeah. You got the cheddar. You got the butter. And then you got the caramel corn.
See? It's not right, though. Is it? It's not called caramel corn.
Boy, Hattie, man. Like, speaking of rabbit trails...
It's called something else, but I can't think of it.
Oh, man, I just got so derailed. What is it called now?
I know. See what I mean?
We'll look that up and then...
Ann loves it.
At the end of the show, let us know what you find. Okay, look. Now, I'm not necessarily... I don't really kind of associate summer with caramel corn or whatever you're talking about.
I'm going to look this up.
I mean, that's not going to get you bikini ready, friend.
No, not at all.
But this is the season of road trips, vacations, making that special mixtape for that long drive. And we've talked about that for years. And heading to the beach, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let me ask you this. Yeah. Are you, there's a lot of people, this is kind of one of those polarizing topics here. Are you kind of like a beach guy? Or do you prefer to like just kind of be on the coast, enjoy the beach a little bit, and then maybe hop in the pool? Like how deep do you get in there? I got a lot of questions that I'm asking you here, but go ahead.
Well, I have an answer that's even going to be better than what the real answer is, and it's called kettle corn. That's what I was thinking of. Anyway, so it's weird. It's like I really love the beach. Like my family, we grew up going to the Keys.
So rich.
Just butlers and, you know, we had a timeshare in Marathon, Florida, which is like in the Keys. And so, like, I kind of grew up in the ocean, you know, dragging for, like, lobsters. And, like, so I love all that stuff. But I don't know. I feel like the older that I get, I think the reason I don't like it as much is mm-hmm. because I know that as a dad.
Because it's coarse and it gets in everything.
Well, that too. But, no, the fact that, like, I know that going to the beach involves me basically making my own personal pilgrimage mm-hmm. out to the beach with like the giant umbrellas.
Oh yeah.
The six giant like wooden chairs.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know
that sucks, but I'm a little bit the opposite. I actually like that part. I want to set it up. I want to get it nice, get some tunes mm-hmm. going. You know, I spent like 3 or 4 hours when I shouldn't have trying to come up with the perfect I'm on the beach playlist, you know, just stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Me personally, though, like the things that have changed since I was a youngster, well, I guess that's not necessarily true. I don't think I've ever been super comfortable with just getting out real deep in the ocean. Now, I've been scuba diving before. That's different. Snorkeling. Mm-hmm. All that's kind of different. I'm just talking about like right off the coast, especially now mm-hmm. as like a dad, I always kind of like put myself deeper than wherever my kids are, because I'm thinking, okay, if there's some kind of crazy creature
going through me first,
yes, I'm gonna fight that shark. And in my mind, and I would say realistically thinking, I'm like, dude, I will rip that freaking shark's jaws mm-hmm. right out of its head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's because I grew up like around like sharks and barracuda and stuff,
just living with them, had them for pets, put them in the bathtub.
I did try to raise clownfish, but that's another that's another episode. It almost got electrocuted.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody around me usually at the beach is like, oh, I'm not gonna go out far. Like, to me it doesn't bother me. I'll go out however far.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just doesn't, it's like it's the same water, it's just a little further out,
right? Just however, you know, a little bit.
If my kids go beyond like 20 feet, I'm like, hey, come on back. Come on back.
Come on back down this way.
So they are not being raised like I was, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the beach, honestly, mm-hmm. it's kind of what prompted me to kind of look back into the archives of my topics list that I've wanted to cover, you know, since we started the podcast. And today's topic kind of seemed to fit it perfectly, man.
Mm-hmm.
But before we really dive into this crazy event that took place in the serene coastal town of Gulf Breeze, Florida,
mm-hmm.
dude, I think it's about time we announce what our campers will be enjoying all summer long at Camp Rad Strangeness.
Oh, I'm psyched, dude.
All right, so for those of you that are kind of newer listeners and maybe weren't with us back last summer and haven't had a chance to kind of dig in and binge our previous episodes, every year, we kind of dedicate the summer to uncovering and exploring the darkest and sometimes most frightening corners of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, yeah, sure. We kind of talk about that stuff anyway, but we're going to go like, we go deeper down the rabbit trail with this. We're talking like small town stories, really kind of strange events, everything from mysterious creatures to unsolved phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically looking for the most obscure stories that will intrigue us all summer long.
Mm-hmm.
And we call it Camp Rad Strangeness.
Well, this year, we're calling it Camp Rad Strangeness international.
Yes.
Yeah, baby.
So we're going global with this thing. We're talking about stuff that us as Americans, but certainly depending on what part of the world you're listening to this show in, you might not have ever heard. We're digging deep, folks.
Ever heard of it.
And since our summer schedules, and I'm sure your summer schedule, listener, can be pretty gnarly, Camp Rad Strangeness kicks off this year on June 19th. So.
And that's 2 days before Tyler, your favorite host's birthday.
Exactly. So besides your birthday presents for Tyler, get your bags packed, your permission slip signed. Go ahead and grab you an army truck full of bug spray because camp is on its way.
Get all your shots.
Yeah, you're going to want to be, you know, your immunizations up to date for sure. Because, I mean, we're going over there. If you have malaria pills, go ahead and, you know, snag a couple of those.
Yep.
And let's get going. Let's head to the waterfront.
Man, I'm really psyched. I feel like last year we may have had a few that were international. I can't remember, but I do remember there were several that were like actually pretty close to us here in the South in the U.S. So it's going to be exciting because, as you know, if you're a fan of this topic of cryptids and all things sort of weird like we are, you definitely know that the entire world is rife with just amazing and weird and creepy things. And we're ready to jump in, man.
Yeah, man. The weirder, the crazier, the more obscure. It's like, oh, I can't wait. So,
yeah.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Something out there waiting for us. And it ain't no man.
Hey, this is Bryce Johnson from the Bigfoot Collectors Club, and you're listening to Tyler and Woody on That Would Be Rad, because that is rad.
This week, we're talking about the crazy event that you heard a little bit about at the top of the show, which has come to be known as the Gulf Breeze UFO incident.
Mm.
For the benefit of our international listeners, or maybe some of our West Coasters, let's talk a little bit about Gulf Breeze, man. You know I like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So Gulf Breeze, Florida, is located at the end of the Fairpoint Peninsula and is the quote-unquote, now this is straight from their tourist official website here, and it is the front porch to Pensacola Beach.
Mm.
Their peninsula city is separated to the north by a...
Hey, real quick, Woody, I got to congratulate you because you are nailing peninsula today.
Peninsula. Don't mess me up, though, dude.
Okay, sorry.
So the peninsula city, I was getting so nervous, said it so fast. Peninsula city is separated to the north by a 3-mile bridge across Pensacola Bay. If you ever get a chance, I mean, a 3-mile bridge, the kids love it. So, you know, get out there. Now, Gulf Breeze, check this out, man. This is super interesting. Has 18 miles of waterfront and 3 protected bayous where residents can enjoy all sorts of waterfront activities. There's this place called the Naval Live Oaks Reservation, which was the home of America's first experimental tree farm, established by President John Quincy Adams in 1828. They're the ones that provided like the raw material to support shipbuilding for the Navy in the area. In Gulf Breeze, you kind of find the best of both worlds, really kind of unspoiled natural beauty and like a really kind of laid back lifestyle. Honestly, this is kind of my beach vibe, you know, like even though that's not where I'm going this summer, when you go to the beach, this is kind of what I prefer, but it's rarely found on the Florida coast because it's just a popular area. Well, the laid-back beach life was what brought people there, and certainly that's what Ed Walters expected to find himself. The year was 1987, a time when the world was captivated by the unknown, with UFO sightings and extraterrestrial encounters making headlines across the globe.
To begin with, we have this concept of the people from other planets as little green men. Are they green from what you know? Are they all the same, or we got different kinds of them?
George, there's at least 70 different species, and probably more. But yes, as odd as it sounds, there are little green men. That's not the ones we usually see, though. We see the little gray ones. They're about 4.5 feet tall.
Against this backdrop of curiosity and wonder, the Gulf Breeze UFO incident unfolded, captivating both skeptics and believers alike. It all began when a local building contractor by the name of Ed Walters reported a series of incredible encounters. At approximately 5 p.m. on November 11th, 1987, Ed was home working at his desk. He saw something out of the corner of his eye and looked up. Through the window just beyond some trees, he saw an unusual glow in the sky. He had never seen anything like it, so he put his work down and went outside to investigate. What he saw from the lawn so startled him that he rushed back into the house and grabbed a Polaroid camera he used from time to time in his work as a building contractor. From the porch, he was able to take four pictures. All that was left of the film in the camera, Ed rushed back into the house for an additional roll of film. Returning to the porch, he reloaded the camera and took a fifth picture. By this time, the object was now approaching the house. Ed moved to the street for a better shot, but before he could take a sixth picture, he was frozen in his tracks. He was caught in a blue beam projecting from the UFO. Ed remained immobilized for approximately 10 seconds. During this time, and just for context, we're going to be quiet now for 10 seconds, and I'm just kidding. Okay. During this time...
God, you had me confused for a second. I was like, wait, what's going
you're
on?
Like, oh, God. During this time, he could not move his eyes or even his eyebrows. He could not expand his chest, and he could barely breathe. In addition to that, he detected a nasty smell. He grew shorter and shorter of a breath and began a series of shallow pants. He was convinced he was about to die.
Wow.
Ed felt an intense pressure surrounding his entire body. He said, "The force holding you is so strong, you don't know it's holding you." He struggled, but to no avail.
Maybe he means like you don't see like a light. You know, it's not like you're seeing like a tractor beam like hit you. You're just all of a sudden like sort of frozen up.
It's probably one of those things too, man, like mentally... You know, like, when something crazy happens in your body is just like, wait, what's going on here? Like,
yeah,
I don't know if
you've
had vertigo or something like that, or
like,
if you're kind of weirded out by heights like I am, and you just kind of look down, your mind's trying to make heads or tails of whatever the heck you're looking at. That's kind of what it seems like. In other words, he's engulfed in this like blue beam of light and he's just trying to move, but he's just like, what the heck? I can't move. I mean, just imagine how that would make you feel. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Well, just then, there he is, terrified. He hears this voice that says,
"Stop this. Stop this. You will not be harmed. Be harmed. Be still. Be still. We will not hurt you."
The voice came from within Ed's head. It was clear and authoritative and nothing like he had ever experienced before. Next, now get this, this is wild, dude. Next, he was shown a book containing pictures of dogs. Beneath each picture was an identifying caption. The pictures, he said, made no sense to him. At this point, what?
I mean, I don't mean to keep interrupting, but he's just talking about like in his mind?
No, He was just showing a book, man. I don't know.
Okay.
At this point, Ed screamed. The sound was muffled. It was like trying to talk while underwater. After a brief time, the beam stopped. When he was released from the beam, Ed thinks he was about 3 feet above the ground. When he fell to the ground, he lurched forward. His knees buckled. He found himself on the blacktop of the street in front of his house. I just imagine a book like floating over his head. I mean, like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know what that... That still got me, but maybe it'll make sense.
I don't think so. All right. As he righted himself, his wife drove up. She had been shopping. She helped Ed pick up the photos lying on the drive where he had dropped them. Now, for the younger listeners, I'm going to break in real quick. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what a Polaroid camera is, it's the kind that you... It's almost like an instant camera. You know, back in the day, before there were iPhones, when you took a picture, you actually mm-hmm. had to wait until all the pictures were kind of used up in the film yep. that you had. Then you take that film and hope that there were no light leaks in your camera or that mm-hmm. you didn't accidentally expose it whenever you were putting it in the little case. You take it to a store, maybe a Walgreens, a CVS, a Kodak or whatever.
Yep.
They develop the film for you, meaning whoever's developing the film gets to see your pictures, so better not send any nudes. And and then you get the pictures at some point later, you know, mm-hmm. by the time we were kind of like late teens, early 20s, it would be like 1 hour a photo was like the big deal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I took a lot of, tons of film to, where did you have yours developed? Like,
there was like a place in the Mall of Georgia and stuff that I would get them done. I mean, tons. Like, I bought like disposable cameras all the time. And
yeah, just
like, you know, you'd take them with you to the beach or like to a party, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Same. Well, and then I need to see if I can find some of those. I was in like a big like photography. So I have like a 60s era Lomo LCA,
mm-hmm.
Which is like basically a Soviet spy camera.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it's awesome. They're still really so cool. Great.
Because like those kind of old cameras you end up with the artifacts that you kind of want. And
in fact,
like when Instagram, for example, first started,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of how they... created these filters that would make it kind of look like that light yep. leaks, you know.
Well, but even the filter, even on your phone, I think it's still, or no, maybe it is Instagram. It's like Lomo 2 or something. Mm-hmm. That's what that's based off of. So
a Polaroid though was different in that you put the film in, you mm-hmm. take a picture, and it would spit out this little, a picture that you would then kind of. Shake it like a Polaroid picture,
mm-hmm.
and you would shake it to kind of help speed up the film being developed. And then, shaking it really does anything? I don't think it makes you feel. It's kind of like when you're in traffic and you switch lanes because you think that other one's faster, and then it's just as slow, and then you switch back. It's just making you think, oh, I'm doing something. I'm mm-hmm. doing, you know.
Yeah.
All right, let's hop back into the story here. So. He had, I guess, scattered these photos all over the ground because he was just terrified, and his wife helped him pick them all up. Well, she noticed that he smelled strongly of something like what she described as cinnamon and ammonia.
Weird.
Ed told her what had happened. She didn't know what to make of his story. Nothing even remotely like this had ever happened to them before. Nor had she seen anything unusual on the way back from the store. One of the things that made Ed's first series of pictures so impressive was that in the shot, the UFO was approximately 20% obscured by the branches and leaves of a blocking tree. Later tests by Bruce McAbee, PhD, a specialist in optics, showed no evidence of bleeding through and no indication that the picture was a double exposure. Again, and, I don't want to get too deep into the photography terms here, but just so that everybody understands, double exposure essentially is I take a picture of the sky, mm-hmm. I take a picture of, you know, XYZ object. Mm-hmm. Then in the development, I don't know the method. Do you know the method?
Well, yeah. So, well, one of the things, I'm not like a, you know, real photographer either, so I don't totally know how they do it, but I do know that, like, for example, with my old Lomo, I know that you could, like, if you went over your limit in film, it wouldn't just like stop. It would just start taking pictures over top of the previous ones you had taken. So like you're double exposing like your new picture, and it's sort of showing as an overlay on top of a previous picture.
Yeah. It's a cool effect. You know what I mean? And you can do it really easy. That's why like stories like this are really intriguing to me, because that technology didn't exist, and it was easy for experts to kind of come in and say, "Whoop, this was a hoax. This is how they did it," you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So anyway, this guy, Bruce McAbee, was a specialist in optics, okay? And he showed that there was no evidence of any of those things that would indicate a double exposure or any kind of bleed through. And further analysis that he did indicated that the photo was genuine in all other respects. If that and the other pictures were not genuine, Ed had gone to unimaginable lengths to create them. Between November 11th, 1987, and May 1988, Ed took a total of 39 pictures of UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the beginning of this incident, but I kind of want to dive into, well, let's talk about the photos for a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The object in Ed's photos resembles a Christmas tree. Well, it kind of looks a little bit like a Christmas tree ornament, or like one of those old sort of metal. You remember those things where it had like a, it was like made out of like a thin sheet metal. And then there's like a little like hand, what would you call it? Like a plunger on top, and you press it down, and the whole thing, as it like sort of shrinks and kind of gets smashed, it sort of spins faster and gets, you know what I'm talking about? That old school toy.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
That's kind of what
it would be made out of tin.
Yeah.
And it would be like crappy colors. Usually they were from like China. They were Chinese made usually. Yeah. It's kind of like a, almost like a top meets like a gyroscope.
Yeah. Something older. Weird like that. Yeah. That's kind of what this reminds me of. But also, you know, it kind of looks like maybe like a king's crown without the fancy spikes at the top. You know, the bottom is brightly lit, and the peak of the rounded top of the object is a single, much smaller, bright light. Below this, closer to the bottom than the top, is a band of what appears to be portholes. Mm-hmm. The proportions are what one would expect. All of the above features are clearly visible with the clarity and ordinarily associated with the Polaroid system. And also, man, here's another thing about the whole double exposure thing. Polaroids, unless this guy knew some sort of hack that I just absolutely don't, You had one button. It took the picture. Mm-hmm. That's it.
That was it.
It spits it out.
Yeah. You pretty much got what you got.
I mean, yeah. And so I don't really know how you'd be able to double expose a Polaroid photo, in other words.
Yeah. I think it's impossible because it's not staying in the camera to be.
You know. And you can't really, well, I don't really know. I don't think you can kind of reload it to take it again. I mean, you'd have to really know your stuff.
Well, also, even just opening it up to put your picture back, or your actual picture back in, I think you would overexpose the whole roll. And
not only that, the way that the Polaroid film would work too, once it's exposed, like those chemicals that exist on that unexposed film, you know, that's what kind of made Polaroid special. Is like there was some sort of chemical reaction that it was done. In other words, if you feed it back through there, I don't think it triggers another one.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay, so Ed estimates that the UFO was about 200 feet away when he first saw it. Mm-hmm. He thinks it was about 18 to 20 feet in diameter and about 10 to 12 feet high. He said that he couldn't tell what it was made of, but whatever it was looked solid. And this always fascinates me, man, it didn't make any noise.
Yeah.
Nor did it emit any kind of exhaust stream, the sort of thing that, you know, we'd expect to kind of be coming out of it if it was powered by like a turbine or jet engine, you know?
Yeah, like sort of like propulsion, like jet propulsion, like you'd think of. Kind of like the planes that shoot out chemtrails.
Jesus. The bottom of the craft, being brightly lit, suggests that maybe that's what its power source was and that it was located at the vehicle's base. Ed saw the UFO or UFOs on an average of once a week, sometimes even more often. between November 11th, 1987 and May 1988, and he experienced at least 20 encounters. During many of the encounters, of course, he was able to take more photos. He said that there were times when he couldn't be certain about the UFO's presence. He would feel or sense its presence but not see anything. At other times, he said there was absolutely no question in his mind about the reality of what was happening. When an encounter was imminent, here we go, man, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Ed would often hear a buzzing in his head.
There it is. Yep.
During a six-month period, Ed took 39 pictures of the objects using several different cameras. Okay, here we go. One of them was a sealed camera. Oh my gosh, dude, I love this stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. One of the cameras that he used was a sealed camera that was provided to him by MUFON.
Yeah, there and we go.
New listeners, unfamiliar with what MUFON stands for, it stands for Mutual Unidentified Flying Objects Network. This is a network of people that are experts in different fields. They kind of investigate this stuff a lot, not just to, you know, I think if you're not, I don't know, super keen on the whole UFO thing in general, you would probably assume, okay, MUFON, they're just a bunch of UFO, like a UFO hunter nuts, you know, that kind of thing. You know, in contrast, I think based on kind of what I've read and as we've kind of dove into cases and stuff, they're really out there to investigate whether or not these things are fraudulent. You know what I'm saying? Like they're not going to these places with, you know, full believer goggles on. They're basically almost in a way trying to not disprove it, but just, you know what I'm saying? They're looking for evidence on both sides of that fence.
Well, I can actually give some greater sort of depth to that. I think I may have said it in like a, maybe like an early episode, but my wife and I actually saw a UFO, and
we'll return after these messages.
It's a pretty cool place if you're a Martian
or a vampire.
You think you really know what's happening around here, don't you?
Fighters for truth, justice, and the American way.
Hey, this is Woody.
And this is Tyler. And you're listening to That Would Be Rad.
And now, back to our show.
You know, I'd never done this before, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to report this to MUFON. And I got on, and there's this huge, I mean, it is, you know, if you're going to do it, just know in advance that, like, it's a decent amount of work. Like, you have to fill out this questionnaire that, I mean, it probably took me an hour just going through all, I mean, to ask like every possible question you could do. Well, then after I do that, the next morning I got up and I had an email asking if I would, you know, be okay with a field agent coming out. And they literally sent this woman out.
Nah, I had forgotten. Kind of like that librarian look. Puts her hair up with like, a pencil.
Hot. More like suit pants, really short hair, like older lady.
And
I mean, this lady was all business. Like, talking to this lady, you would think that she would have never even entertained the idea of UFOs even being real, wow. Much less. Yeah, I mean, like, as,
intimidating, you know, a little bit, or?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, but and I had forgotten. Yeah. She was great. But I had forgotten, so I had, like, pajamas on, which, you know, it doesn't give you the same amount of confidence as you would have with regular clothes on.
Yeah, but you're and right. So, probably not you, but you know me.
Well, no, but she's asking me. I'm like walking around the yard with her, and my neighbors are looking at me because I just have like pajama pants on.
Oh, man. They're like, yeah, who's that loser?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I mean, she came out, and she probably took, I mean, she was probably there like an hour and a half. And I'm
just
talking,
like asking you a bunch of questions, or
every possible question. Like she even had this like little, and I don't know if this is like a, you know, a standard like field agent thing, but she had like this like little, how would I even explain it? It's like, imagine like these like like different layers of cardboard that's like all hinged in the middle with like a one of those like little gold pins. So basically she's like, okay, was it this big? And she slides it and it shows like that it would be a little bit bigger, slides it a little bit bigger. So basically she wanted to know exactly where I was standing and how big it was in my field of vision to be able to tell like the distance. I mean, it was amazing. I was really, really impressed. Yeah. But yeah, they're, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's some folks that are tied into it, just like with everything else, who are, you know, kind of shake things up.
Well, I mean, they got
to
be kind of like interested in it, you know, to pursue a career with that. But
Right. But I, from what I've seen, like on a personal level, like it was all business, like super, super credible. Yeah.
That's really cool. Anyway, that's MUFON. All right. So listen to this, dude. Perhaps like what's regarded as, I don't know if they're the most famous photos in this sort of set, but maybe the most valuable, January 12th, 1988, 5:25 p.m., Ed left his home in a pickup truck to check on an electrical meter installation in a building being prepared for county inspection. The building was located about 7 miles east of Gulf Breeze on Highway 191. About half a mile down, an object flying in the same direction as Ed was driving passed directly over his vehicle. As it came into view, it directed what appeared to be a powerful white flash of light right through the windshield. The light affected Ed's forearms and hands, making them difficult to use. They stung and became numb. They felt like they were being pricked by a dozen pins. Ed immediately pulled off the road and stopped. The object was then hovering directly in front of him, less than 200 feet away. It was no more than 2 or 3 feet to the left of the double yellow center line, and no more than 4 or 5 feet above the ground. Tense with fear, Ed tried to reach his shotgun behind the seat, attaboy. In the process, he knocked his Polaroid camera to the floor. He could clearly see the glow of the object's underside reflected by the pavement.
Which, by the way, before you continue, to give like a visual, at least to me, the bottom, like if you imagine this sort of a saucer kind of thing, to me, the bottom looks like the old school, like underwater, like pool lights.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Like the really old ones that you could have, like, it would have like rivets around.
It kind of reminds me of the Close Encounters. This whole
a little bit,
scene
yeah.
is just a very Close Encounters vibe.
Yeah, which, by the way, I mean, that's synchronicity. Should I tell what I learned over the weekend? Little known fact that I learned over the weekend, and I never knew this, but J. Allen Hynek, the guy who was sort of known for Project Blue Book, which was sent out by the U.S. military to pretty much debunk UFO claims or extraterrestrials, he actually had a classification of UFOs and, you know, the first kind, third kind. And so Close Encounters of the Third Kind was actually inspired by that. And actually he worked as a sort of as a, what would you call it? Like a contributor or like a...
Like a liaison? No, like a...
That's what I was going to say.
What is it? You know, like a, not a contractor. I know what you're talking about. Hold on.
Yeah, I think it starts with a C too, because I keep going to that. But he worked...
Coordinator.
No... Contributor? No, that's not right still. Anyway, so J. Allen Hynek actually was even given a cameo, and he's actually in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I didn't know until this past weekend. Yeah. So,
man, cool. That's amazing.
Yeah, real cool.
So there Ed was, with his gun in his lap. He retrieved the camera and took a picture of the object through the windshield. As soon as he took the picture, the craft's glow intensified, and the ship started to move toward him. The craft beam was still present, causing Ed to feel increasingly threatened. So to protect himself, he grabbed his gun together with the camera and got out of the truck. Now, I'm just going to make a quick commentary here. You know, everybody's always dogging the younger generation for trying to, like, take a picture of everything. This guy is facing a crazy, scary UFO. He's got his gun, but he's like, well, I better take my camera, too.
Yeah.
Back into it here. He began crawling underneath the vehicle for protection. But before he could get completely under the truck, the beam caught his legs just below the knees. The feeling was the same as he had experienced a minute or so earlier in his arms and hands. Remember, like the numbness, the tingling, the pins and needles. The object's position was essentially unchanged. Ed tried to get a second photo of the craft from under the truck, but failed. At this point, the object began to rotate and to project a blue beam from which five creatures emerged. The aliens appeared quickly, one after the other.
You mean like beaming them down? Like, I'm just trying to get a visual here.
Yeah, no, I guess they just, there's a beam. These five creatures emerge. All this takes place in less than 10 seconds. The beings were then between 3 and 4 feet tall and wore what appeared to be protective shields. And listen to this, dude. Each of them carried a glowing rod, and they started walking toward Ed.
Oh, boy.
The first thing they asked him was, where's our book of dogs? I'm just kidding.
Dude, I was about to say the same thing.
Oh, God. Oh, man, you're here for the dog show? All right.
I mean, dude, I am, like, in all seriousness, I'm still hung up on this dog book situation.
Well, now we got,
I have no idea what that means.
This guy, they got lightsabers. All right, forget about the dogs. Okay. Obviously, near panic, Ed scrambled from underneath the truck, threw the camera and the gun on the seat, and managed to scramble inside.
I mean, real quick, it feels very much like Travis Walton, like Fire in the Sky. That's just sort of the visuals that I'm getting.
Yeah. And mixed with the Close Encounters. And I mean, it's just that's the time period, though, you know?
Yeah, right. Okay.
Not realizing the truck was still running, he turned the ignition key. We all know what happens when that happens, right? You make that weird, like, the starter motor made a grinding sound.
Oh, boy.
Absolutely frantic.
Like when you crank it twice?
Yeah, exactly. It's already running. You try to do it again, it makes that weird grinding. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's super frantic. He slams the shift, the stick shift into reverse, pushed the gas pedal to the floor, and backed up enough to turn around and get into drive, and exited just pedal to the metal, man. Once he was a safe distance away, Ed looked at the picture he had taken. It turned out to be as good as the rest of the experience was bad. This was the first photo that had sufficient reference points to compute the size of the object and the distance from the camera. The width of Highway 191 at this point was 20 feet. In his analysis using the original Polaroid photograph, Dr. Bruce Maccabee determined that the object was 12 foot in diameter and 8 feet high, not counting the light on top. But utilizing the tire indentations on the left-hand side of the highway, where Mr. Ed pulled his pickup truck off on the soft shoulder, and aligning a tree above the object with this point, the distance to the object was approximately 185 feet. The beings that Ed saw during this sighting were actually the same as one that he had seen earlier on December 2nd, 1987. Now, on that date, around 3 a.m., Ed was awakened by a humming sound. At first, he thought it was his swimming pool pump. A few moments later, he thought he heard a baby crying. There are no infants in Ed's family.
That's common, man.
Fully awake now, he heard a conversation between a man and a woman in Spanish, but he couldn't make any sense of it. Armed with a pistol and with camera in hand, Ed quietly slipped out of bed to investigate. He went into the backyard and saw a craft hovering just beyond his back fence. He photographed it, and after a few minutes, the object went away. Ed returned to bed. I love that it's so common for this dude that he's able to just go, you know, snag a couple extra Z's after seeing a freaking UFO floating around his backyard. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then at 3:30, Ed heard his dog bark once. This was unusual because his dog usually continues to bark until Ed or another family member is alerted. Again, Ed quietly slipped out of bed and crawled to the French doors. Crawled to the French doors where he raised the blind. He stopped to take a look. Directly opposite the doors was a creature. It was approximately 4 feet tall and was peering directly at Ed. Its proportions were similar to those of a human. Astonished, Ed let out a yell and fell backwards, He had been prepared for another sighting, but not a face-to-face meeting with an unknown creature.
Yeah.
As Ed got to his feet, he saw the creature turn and run outside of the screened porch. Now, this freaking creature was inside his screened porch, dude. I mean, oh my God, that would be just terrifying. Again, he says that it was about 4 feet tall with a shield over its head, chest, and lower body.
And what does he mean by shield?
I'm thinking he just means like some sort of like shield covering, like maybe, I don't know, imagine a spacesuit or something. I'm not sure. He says, though, that it's got distinctive large almond-shaped eyes that were observed through a clear portion of the head mask, he says. It was holding an illuminated rod in its right hand, even though it was dark, he said. The outline of the creature was visible because of the distant background lights and illumination from the rod. Now, Ed, although that startled him, doesn't really seem like the guy to kind of like just let his fear kind of rule the situation, because he then unbolted the French doors and went outside, following the creature. The creature was clearly visible, running toward a field behind the house. Before Ed could move off of his porch, though, he was hit by another blue beam of light coming from a craft overhead. The blue beam, essentially, he said, nailed one of his legs from knee to foot to the wooden floor. In other words, completely froze him.
Yeah, right.
Moments later, the beam stopped, and Ed rushed back into the house and got his camera. There he is. He was actually able to take a picture of this craft, and it was similar to the first photos taken back on November 11th. Ed believes that the creature returned to the craft by way of that blue beam. So just like, you know, you kind of said, maybe that's how they go in and out.
I'm sending you this, and this is what he's talking about by shields, which suddenly makes sense to me.
Oh, man.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, we got to keep that, yeah. Again, yeah, cool. The expert who's done the most to validate Ed's long and detailed experience is Bruce Maccabee. Maccabee has a doctorate in physics and specializes in optics, like we said earlier. Among those clients he has done work for is the U.S. Navy. He was based in Washington, D.C., and is among the nation's most respected UFO consultants.
Straight-up optical physicist. Like
was consultant he knows the word you were looking for?
Consultant. That's exactly the word. Yeah, I knew it was
I think the lesson here is if you just wait, right?
Okay.
Before you just interrupt, like, Woody's
you couldn't
gonna,
think of it either.
He's probably going to get there.
Okay. An hour later.
Yeah. Let's see. So one of the things he specializes in is analyzing photos of UFOs, the first of which he started examining back in 1950, bro.
Man, that's awesome.
He's written extensively about the Gulf Breeze sightings, and even back in June of 1988, presented a 90-page paper on Ed's photos to MUFON.
Yeah, I've got to interject and say that this is as many things that, you know, could be like quote unquote like wrong with this case.
Mm-hmm.
I think Maccabee is like by far the most sort of he gives the most like credibility to this thing.
Mm. Yeah,
for sure.
And he's like super respected in the field.
Right.
And I mean, maybe Tyler, you know more about Maccabee's sort of. Maybe you can think of some cases where he's actually proven that, oh, no, this is, you know, this is something fake. This is a hoax or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I can't think of any right offhand, but I think he was.
No, that's disappointing. So,
I mean, I can look.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of sprung this on me. But no, I didn't know that he was a consultant. I thought he was like in the military, like a military.
Well, I'm sure maybe he, well, I don't know. Yeah. Mm. Oh, and now listen to this too. Ed Walters wasn't the only person that saw these things. So as we kind of dig, as this story came out, okay, the way that it did come out is Ed Walters initially was kind of like an anonymous source, and he walked into the Gulf Breeze paper, and this is how he did it, man. This is pretty gangster. He walks into the office, throws these photos down, and starts telling him the story.
Yeah.
The reporter has said, like, I was kind of awestruck, and just like a lot of us out there, you know, the initial reaction is like, okay, well, this kind of sounds fake and, you know, la da da da. But again, it's important to note that Ed wasn't the only person that saw these things flying around in that area. There have been sightings in and around the area. Gulf Breeze is pretty close to Gulf Shores, Alabama, which is a little bit further west from Gulf Breeze, and then out in just other areas of Florida around the same time. There are about 55 other reported sightings between November of 1987 and May 1988, including Ed's.
So looking up Maccabee, he was like a pretty big member of MUFON. So I wonder if they sort of appointed him to go out and sort of check it out. You know,
I'm sure
that would make sense,
because this is one of those cases where there are multiple witnesses.
Yeah.
We also have photographic evidence, and not just like a few. Remember, it was like something like 39 photos or some crazy thing. Tons of it, right? Mm-hmm. I would dare say, I mean, you can kind of correct me on this again. I'm putting you on the spot. I wonder if this might be the most, like, the biggest collection of photos from a single sort of source, maybe ever.
I think so. Well, there's another, and I think his name may be Bruce too, but I think Adamski was like from back in the 60s or 70s. God, you are putting me on the spot here.
I'm just saying, like, just from like one event, that's just usually there's just like one blurry photo or one.
Yeah, that's,
I mean, you know what I mean? One like,
yeah, this is
film
a
clip. Listen to this quote by Maccabee, dude. This is a powerful quote here. He says, "After hundreds of hours of painstaking research, I have found nothing in the photos taken by Ed which would refute the sighting reports. My opinion is that the photos are genuine and that these crafts are not from Earth."
I mean, that's pretty...
Yeah.
So wait a minute. So there are like corroborating like witnesses that we're seeing at the same time?
Yep. 55 other reported sightings, dude, including Ed's. I mean, not including Ed's. So an additional 55 reporting.
Yeah, that's reported. That's a big deal.
I mean, one of them even is, I've got this article, one of them is a Gulf Breeze councilwoman. Her name was Brenda Pollack. And she said that on March 17th, she was crossing the Pensacola Bay Bridge when she saw a strange orange light pulsating over Gulf Breeze. She said that the object was moving just above the treetops, and it was larger and brighter than any aircraft light she had ever seen. She lost sight of the object as she got off the bridge, but she saw it again as she drove along Shoreline Drive. She said she pulled over and watched the object for 3 or 4 seconds before it suddenly disappeared. Upon returning home, she found a note from her husband, Buddy, saying that he had gone to Shoreline Park. Well, when she got to the park, she said she found her husband and several others examining photographs under the headlights of a truck. She was told that, quote, Jim, the Gulf Breeze businessman who says he was... Okay, this is back when he was anonymous, okay? And so Ed would sometimes go by Jim. She was told that Jim, the Gulf Breeze businessman who said he had taken 37 photographs of UFOs, had just snapped two simultaneous photographs.
And by the way, just to clarify, you mean Ed Walters?
Yes.
Originally went
by Jim. Yep.
Yeah.
He had asked to remain anonymous. Again, he wanted to protect his business, you know, by not just coming out and saying, I saw a UFO and little people and all this. I mean, there's just like a ton of them, dude. There's a...
And real quick, were these reported to like the local police?
Newspaper. I'm sure they were reported to the local police. I have a clip of the article from the News Journal, May 21st, 1988.
Wow. I mean, the skeptic part of me would ask, like, okay, well, were these people like friends, you know? Was this like sort of a coordinated effort? But I mean, again, back then, like this is early 80s, late 80s. It wasn't like it is today. You know, we had landlines and so I don't know. That's pretty interesting. This is one thing that I have never known about this case. I thought it pretty much all rested on the shoulders of Ed Walters. So like, to hear that there were like multiple witnesses that were seeing the same things like on the same days, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, For sure, man. And also, so this area, there's this other article I found, same newspaper, Pensacola News Journal, March 5th, 1989. And the title of the article says, UFO fever strikes West Florida. Here, I got to read the intro paragraph because I feel like the lady that wrote it, Cindy West, is just one of us. So she starts it like this. Residents of galaxies far, far away may have visited West Florida long before unidentified flying objects were spotted over Gulf Breeze in 1987. Sightings go back at least to the 1950s when on March 31st, 1953, a man saw one of the objects in the Pensacola area. He said, "I'll swear I saw a flying saucer at 10:40 a.m. Tuesday," said George M. Lee of Pensacola. Lee, a postal employee, said he was driving north on E Street, just south of Pottery Plant Road, when he glanced up and saw a round, shiny object to the northwest. He said a few seconds after he spotted the motionless object, began moving straight upward and then disappeared completely. In 1973, there was a rash of sightings. In October of 1973, a man reported he saw four faint white objects flying silently northeast across the sky, about 13 miles east of Destin. Mm. October 17th, just after dark, Eglin radar personnel reported tracking UFO in the area north of Eglin. And about the same time, more than a half dozen motorists stopped their cars to watch four lighted UFOs hover above Interstate 10 between Crossview and Milton. Now, again, this is 1973. 1975, a dozen Holmes County residents and two sheriff's deputies said that they saw a large, glowing, egg-shaped UFO fly at sharp angles just above the treetops near Bonifay. I mean, it just keeps on going, dude.
Yeah,
all the way until like 1987. And, you know, well, there's one more thing I want to say that's kind of interesting. So
we will return after these messages.
America's future can be determined by our dreams and our visions.
It was very intense, bright light.
For over 200 years, there have been reports of giant, man-like creatures.
From another dimension, another world, I don't know.
The most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
This is Joshua Cutchin, and you're at my home for weirdness. That would be rad.
A few years after all this happened, getting kind of closer to the 90s, Ed Walters had since sold his home and moved elsewhere. It was June 10th, 1990. Basically, this guy who had moved into Ed's home found a model that was made up of four plastic foam plates and some drafting paper that was found in the attic of Ed Walters' old home. Mm-hmm. The model closely resembled the UFO craft in some of the photos. Walters denied knowledge of the model and stated that someone who wants to discredit him must have put the model in the house and refused to take a lie detector test at the time, but signed a sworn statement denying any knowledge of the model UFO. Mm-hmm. The man who found the model signed a sworn statement that he did not know who had made it, and News Journal photographers experimented with the model and were able to nearly duplicate some of the photos of UFOs printed in Walters' book. Ed Walters had since published these photos in a book. And then again, as this kind of stuff kind of came out, you know, obviously critics kind of latched onto that. But the folks over at MUFON and stuff said, look, there were way too many other eyewitnesses who had seen something similar that debunkers would need to go to great lengths to discredit. And, you know, they found this thing. But, you know, I don't know. It still doesn't account for all of the various sightings. It doesn't account for the fact that there were Polaroid photos. I don't know how that you fake a Polaroid photo, man.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wrap it all up, you know, I'm looking at the photos here, or at least some of them. And I think, listener, I would kind of love to hear what you think about these photos as well. It is real hard. They're so distinct.
Yeah.
The object is that it is hard to, I don't know. I think initially anybody's going to look at this and be like, oh, fake, because it's so clear and so good. I don't know how you get such a clear photo when others haven't really necessarily been able to, especially given the circumstances of his story where he's got a dadgum shotgun in his lap and he's like, oh, I better pick up the camera. Click. Oh, it's perfect. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, no matter what, I'm kind of still stuck on the dog book. I don't understand what's going on there.
That's my biggest question.
I think that there have been plenty of people about this case specifically that are very skeptical about it from the get-go. And then on top of them finding this little like model, I don't know what to think, man, other than it's super interesting and it gets me in the vibe of, whenever I go to the beach this year in Florida, I'm going to be looking for UFOs.
Oh, yeah, dude. I mean, the part of the reason that I was so excited about this particular case is I've said a million times on the show, but like my buddy and I, Jesse Phillips, hey, Jesse, he's like my oldest friend. We've been friends since like the fourth grade, and we were always massively into UFOs. And so this hit right around that time, which I always thought that it was in the 90s. That's weird. But yeah, that was like because of this particular thing, every single time I would go to the beach, I mean, I would spend like hours at night just looking out over the ocean. And I mean, you do see some interesting things, but I don't recall ever like, full on seeing like, definitive, like what I could call a UFO at the beach, which still kind of bums me out because you heard all these stories, especially all through. I think Florida may still be the record holder for like the most UFOs per state as far as sightings go. But yeah, this case was really interesting. Like I said before, I never knew that there were other sort of corroborating witnesses. So to me, that lends a little more credibility. I think to me, the thing that kind of like sent my red flags of like, maybe this is a hoax is like the one with like the beam.
Mm-hmm. You mean the picture?
The picture with like it looks like the little tractor beams kind of coming out. I don't know. There's something about that just feels like a flashlight. Mm-hmm. But after saying that, then you have this optical physicist, Bruce McAbee, who is, well known for all this stuff. I mean, he's, a pretty big guy in that field. Yeah. And, he's saying, okay, I'm looking at this picture. I'm looking at like the markers I'm looking at, which are, providing like scale, and this craft is 12 foot long and yada, yada, yada. And so I don't really know how you fake that with a professional at the top of his field, optical physicist. That's sort of where I'm like,
he's kind of putting a lot on the line, man.
He sure is. Yeah.
He's immediately kind of potentially discrediting himself. I mean, that's the 100%. Difficulty about all this stuff is, and I mean, we see this in like court cases all the time, right? Mm-hmm. You can get like an expert on the stand, and each sort of side, the defendant and the plaintiff, will have their own experts, and they can look at the same data or the same event. They can see like two different outcomes, basically, is right. Kind of what I'm trying to say here. And so it makes it super, super hard. And, it's not impossible for someone to kind of fake photographs like this. It happens all the time back then. But man alive, it's super interesting. And if this thing was real, I don't know.
Well, and also, I mean, the idea that like they found like the replica in the attic, I feel like there's a couple things.
Yeah, that's kind of tough.
Although
maybe the dude just likes to make, like the problem is.
Well, no,
he's like, dude, I don't even know who, I don't know what.
Yeah,
that
he
is.
Flat out like denied.
Yeah.
That being in there. So here's my sort of consensus on this. I think that in order for that to have like truthfully happened, like they found this replica in his attic, I feel like number one, if you're moving out of your house, you're just going to leave that there. Like that just doesn't make logical sense. Number two, if you're, I mean, this story is like you're not only are you sort of convincing the public that you've had these sort of encounters with these UFOs and these aliens, extraterrestrials, you're also having to convince, like, that was the thing too. Like, he was all, like, his wife sort of publicly came out and was like, I've seen all these changes in my husband, blah, 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 blah. And so you're telling me that she wouldn't have known about a replica up in your attic?
Here's what it sounds like to me. I bet she, like, got this thing made, put it in the attic because it was going to be a surprise gift. He starts acting crazy. And she's like, well, I better not. And then kind of, you know, dude, you know how many presents I've found like hidden up in our, like in like my old office closet and stuff? I'm like, oof, yeah. Man, I forgot to, well, they don't like Paw Patrol anymore. So I guess I'll, you know what I mean? So yeah. Maybe that's what happened.
In like an old hollowed out tree trunk in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of.
And you know, since then, obviously nowadays, there's all kinds of better technology and stuff and techniques that are a little bit more advanced than they were when all this, you know, initially was investigated and stuff. And some folks have claimed that they found evidence of manipulation, and others say that, you know, the original negatives remain unaltered. And it's still an ongoing mystery. Was it a hoax? Was it not a hoax?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because, okay, so hypothetically, say that you fully believe that it's a hoax, which would then in turn mean that you fully believe that that recreation that was found in his attic was basically what he used to hoax these photos, right?
Right.
I just find it difficult to wrap my head around that, because that would mean, like, some of the photos that you see, like, one was on the side of a road, just up in the air. So it's like, okay, well, how are they getting? And the other thing is it's not like you're thinking, oh, well, there's just this, like, recreation of this thing that's, like, in the shape of a plane. So I can just throw it up in the air, take the picture, the end. This would require this thing being massive. Mm-hmm. And so, like, how did they get this up there? And then how did you take it with a Polaroid? It's just, there's so many things about it that, like, that's just hard. I mean, I think for me, the big thing that, like, sort of sends me into sort of on to the skeptic side is that every photo, it's like the same craft, which I will say, like, you know, you saying that there were all these, like, sort of multiple witnesses. I mean, that does kind of take a little bit of that away. Like, to me, that gives a little more credibility to that, you know? So maybe it was like a, almost like a flap, you know, you think of like the Flatwoods Monster or something. Mm-hmm. It's like, maybe this was this one particular craft. I mean, do we know like how many, like how long this flap would have happened with Walters? Do we know?
Yeah. So it was in November 11th, 1987 to May, 1988.
I mean, that's not too long.
It's like 6 months, man. And I mean, I guess maybe I don't understand the argument for it being a different, different craft.
Well, I don't know. There's just something like that just feels weird to me about you're always getting like this exact same craft instead of like this person over here saw this thing, but it looked kind of different. This person over here, and it's like in every single photo is the exact same one. Like, I don't know. There's something about that sort of perks up my like BS meter a little bit. But again, I don't know how he's like staging this stuff and making it work to get this massive recreation up in the air,
and then
only using. I mean, he's on the side of the road. Like,
yeah, no, but I guess maybe like if he. No, he's like a carpenter or something, right? Like he has a business of
well, he's like a contractor, yeah.
Contractor, okay. So
like a building contractor.
He's probably pretty good at like, you know, geometry and stuff like that. And so he can potentially, now just imagine that you've got this model and you've got like on a fishing pole or something, and it's just like dangling. You know how to set up the distance so that it can be like, okay, if that is that long and this is that, then I need to put it right there. I mean, it's not impossible. It's just... Boy.
Yeah, but dude, just look at this. I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Like, I don't know how you fake that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That one looks more like it would have to have been like a double exposure thing. And then, like, I've got one in that series that's like right before that. You know, it's bizarre, dude.
But the double exposure trick is, I think, to make it look like it's like illuminated, I think that's going to be a lot harder. If it is truly double exposure, like I don't know, I don't know the ins and outs. I don't know. Again, I still look at the one with the beam, and that's the one that I remember.
Which one are you talking about?
Sure, Eric. That's the one that always sort of felt like, I don't know, man. It just feels.
Oh yeah, that one is intense. Look.
I mean, it looks awesome, but it just looks kind of like a flashlight.
It's almost like if this was a hoax. then like he kind of used the time period to kind of perfect his methods.
Yeah.
And kind of we're kind of looking at the best of the best out of that batch.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I will say, dude, look at the one that you sent me in the far left corner, which I've always kind of felt like that one looked a little fake. But at the same time, like, there's no way of getting around. There's no way of faking the scale of that. So even if it is a recreation,
and then the light on the bottom of the road, bro.
That's what I'm saying. That's why you can't fake how big this thing is, because that's the light itself is stretching all the like a spotlight,
like the top right, the top right corner. That kind of looks like, you know, your summer camp flashlight close up.
Right.
The one below that is similar to the other one that you had. The other two in the middle are like, okay, but that, you're right, man. That bottom left corner one,
there's no way of faking.
I can't wrap my head around how you'd be able to do that.
I mean, unless you have like out of frame, you have like a literal crane holding this thing above a road.
Or you've made like a model of the road and you set up like a little scene outside so that like it's natural light. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like, we're having to do all kinds of Olympics here just to get this done. Now, a lot of times, most of the time, I would say, we'll say things like, well, why would this person do it? Because they didn't even profit of it. In this case, however, he did release this book. Mm-hmm. And so technically speaking, he has profited from it.
Yeah.
So but that's when it gets a little hard to kind of like, you know, just draw that line in the beach sand, so to speak.
Yeah, there it is. You know, to me, I think that is kind of an unfair sort of attack that like skeptics have used for years. I mean, it's like, I get it. I understand like, oh, well, they're, you know, it's easy to look at it very sort of idealistically of like, oh, well, see, they're a charlatan. They're making this thing up to make money. There's the motivation. But I kind of think like, I mean, honestly, man, I've had my own stuff. I've seen things, you know, I've seen a UFO with my wife. I've, you know, had a shadow person encounter. I've had a missing time thing. And I could see how somebody would listen to me say that and be like, oh, there's no way that somebody can just experience all those things. And in fact, before like this show,
I'm one of them.
Yeah, thank you. Before the show, I have always looked at people that were like, oh, I've seen this kind of thing. I've seen this kind of thing. I always looked at those people as like, oh, that's BS. Like, you're doing too much now. But once we got on the show, it was like, oh, wait a minute. I've actually encountered a lot of these things too. And so I think the motivation of saying, oh, well, just he wrote a book, so that therein lies the motivation. I think that's unfair. So let's look at it completely sort of, I mean, I guess altruistically, really.
Okay.
Let's say this guy is a contractor. He doesn't have a bad bone in his body. He's not trying to fool anybody. He just goes to work. He's a blue-collar guy. And he starts encountering these things. He starts seeing this flap of this object that keeps showing up. And it just like me with my like orb thing,
He starts crying.
He starts crying. No, I became obsessed with this. I became so involved with like every spare second of the day. I was thinking about it. I was getting online. I was like perusing every forum I could find to try to like discover somebody else that had sort of had a similar encounter. So you take that like rabid curiosity, and like he doesn't have the internet. I'm sure he's going to libraries. I'm sure he's blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But like, think about it. Around this time, this is when like sort of the UFO craze, you know, late 80s, early 90s. I think it's only a natural progression for him to be like, you know what? Maybe nobody will ever buy this book, but I'm going to make a book and show my evidence, what I've captured on film.
Yeah, yeah.
True, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No. And I wasn't trying to say that. Look, man.
No, I know. I'm not saying you were.
Even if it, like, well, I was going to say, even if it is a hoax, because it's so relatively well done, you know, I don't know how I feel about that. Because the problem is if or when people do these hoaxes that are so elaborate and everything, it then begins to discredit all the people that are just trying to tell the real story. Mm-hmm. And that sucks. So
yeah,
hopefully it wasn't. But no matter what, dude, like, here's the beauty of That Would Be Rad. And part of the reason why we've even started this is I love reading about these stories I previously didn't know much about. I mean, this story probably was one of the reasons that kind of kicked up the dust and reignited the interest in the UFO craze. And I mean, there is an Unsolved Mysteries episode about it. I'm sure, you know, as we started getting a little bit older and into the 90s, you know, X-Files and all that, there was just like this moment in history where it was super fun to talk about these things. And by golly, heading to the beach, this is something fun to think about, man. Hey, now look out and be careful at night.
Oh, yeah.
I always, you know, I, unlike Tyler, have had basically zero of those types of experiences other than the scary experience that I had that's back in our first Halloween special or whatever that I told about.
Hear Woody's terrifying real life experience on That Would Be Rad, Season 1, Episode 10. The Halloween Spooktacular.
I haven't had any of those moments that I can't just chalk it up to, like, oh man, it's my imagination, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's not me kind of discrediting anybody that has. It's just, I kind of don't go looking for that stuff, really. And I think that is, you know, just my nature. Mm-hmm. Kind of like we talked about last week when we were talking about all the different names of magic. You know, I kind of shy away from that stuff because I don't want to open up a door that I can't close.
Right.
And that includes, you know, 4-foot-tall green men with lightsabers coming after me.
Yeah.
Not interested, man. You know what I mean?
I do like that you brought up, and I've been kind of thinking about this lately with, like, some of the stuff we've been into, but you mentioned something about in one of his accounts where it was like they knew when he was, like, either looking or when he was, like, taking a picture or something. And I do think there could be something with, and it's from my own sort of, experiences and encounters of, like, with the orbs, for example, when there was a knowing of when I was looking at this thing. It was like, it was like they knew immediately that I was looking. And I've always thought that was really fascinating. And I mean, it can kind of get into, you know, like Stephen Greer, he gets really big into, like, intention and like, oh, they'll go out into the desert and they'll, like, meditate. And then, like, you know, they'll see these lights and then they'll, like, blink out and then they'll all, like, focus their intention of, like, well, we want you to show back up, and then it'll show back up. And, like, I wonder if there's something to that, and, you know, whether it be with aliens or cryptids or with my orb situation or UFOs, you know, flying in the sky, I wonder if there's something between that and then something like the observer effect or like quantum entanglement or like the double slit experiment where certain like particles are doing something only when they're being observed by people. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's like, and it gets super heady and super, you know, quantum, you know, physics and that kind of thing. But I don't know. Lately, that's been something that's been popping up. I've been kind of thinking about it in those terms of like, man, there could be something to that. Maybe there is like whatever that thing that's happening with like the double slit experiment where, these protons or whatever are only going in this one side whenever everybody stops observing it. But then the second you start observing it, then it goes back to random and it's going into like the different like, you know, sides of like the slits or whatever. And so like, I don't know. I think that's an interesting thing. And I thought, you know, I should at least bring it onto the show just to throw out there.
I mean, who's to say that an advanced technology doesn't exist that can, you know, measure and react to consciousness and like, you know, all that kind of stuff. So if if it measures our brain waves, for example, even like taking it real super simple in its most sort of like simplistic technology, if they're able to somehow from, you know, the craft that they're in, measure those changes in our brainwaves, maybe mm-hmm. that triggers them being like, they're looking at us, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting that you said that. So I want to do an episode where we break this down because I'm terrible with names and titles and stuff, but there is a sort of piece of ufology lore that I've always found fascinating where I think he's a top guy from like Skunk Works, which is like, you know, they're like the military contractor who they came up with like the stealth or like the SR-71 Blackbird. And like, they're the people who contract or the military contracts to build these, like, you know, we're talking like top of the line, like the most advanced stuff, you know, mm-hmm. with stealth and like technology. And, you know, then it's sort of weaponized by like the, you know, big military or whatever. But there was a conference where, you know, this top guy was taking questions, and, you know, he made this comment of, not only are we able to see ET, but now we're able to take him back home, which is already, that's a really cool sort of line. Mm-hmm. But the story goes, there's this UFO researcher, and I want to do an episode where we really get into it, but this UFO researcher sort of chases this guy down as he's leaving this conference. And he runs up to him and he's like, hey, you know, I heard you said this about like being able to take ET home, yada, 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 whatever question he asked about, like, well, you know, what all can we do or whatever, or something to that extent. And he said he like stopped for a second and then he looked at him and he said, what do you think is the main mystery about UFOs or something to that extent? And he says, well, it's probably, you know, anti-gravitic, you know, propulsions, and like, are they capable of that? He said he like kind of like smiled, and then his response was, actually, no. What do you know about ESP? And he said that the researcher guy was like, what? And like, that was like his answer of like, hey, you're missing it. It's not about, you know, anti-gravity stuff. It's not about all this stuff. It's about like something, whatever it is tied to like extrasensory perception and being able to, I think it has something to do with like bilocation and like that whole thing. So like, you have a guy from like the top of the bleeding edge of technology, and he's talking about, you know, UFOs actually being about ESP. I don't know. It's just, man, it's really fascinating. And yeah, I think that goes into what you were just saying, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's also, it's kind of like one of those things. This is why I get so like frustrated when folks are just quick to dismiss, you know, technological possibilities, right? So I don't remember if I sent you this video, but anyways, when you super cool certain things and you put it in a magnetic field, essentially this thing will, you know, appear to float on top of this object. Like, you can manipulate it, you know, like turn it a certain way, and like it's just gonna stay there. It's amazing. There's all sorts of like things that we know of as humans currently, physics and chemistry and all these different things that we're continually discovering. And I read a really cool sort of article as well that was talking about the science of failure. And it was talking about, like, you know, and hold your tongue for just a second, but talking about Elon Musk and, you know, people criticizing when the rocket launch doesn't go as planned or isn't a successful launch and all these kind of things. I think the misconception in sort of the general community will say is that like science is only about discovery and only about success and stuff. When in reality, like, science is built up so much on failure, because you have these ideas, these thoughts, and then you experiment them and it doesn't work out the way you do. And so you adjust and you keep on going to sort of see if your theory is correct, you know? And so as such, we're still kind of discovering all these different things. It's so hard for me to like truly, like, it's harder for me to believe that there's no such thing as any of this stuff, aliens, other life forms, you know, animals that are undiscovered, all this. It's harder for me to believe that it's just absolutely not anything.
Right.
Than it is for me to just like think, well, man, there's infinite possibilities here, you know? I think that's why I like a lot of this stuff so much. And it's so intriguing and interesting. It's not so much that like Hey, I care if you, listener, are someone that believes this stuff, or if you're really just kind of here because, you know, you want to hear us talk about He-Man or indie rock, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
In either case, like, both Tyler and I are so intrigued by, like, story that, like,
yeah,
being able to dig into these stories and stuff and these events and then sprinkle in freaking any kind of evidence on top of that and then multiple mm-hmm. witnesses, you know, it starts to get harder and harder to fake that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And if that's true, then it becomes more and more interesting to me that stuff's happening out there. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's totally bizarre and interesting and, well, I mean, rad, frankly.
Yeah, dude.
Anyway, I thought this case was the perfect thing to talk about to kind of kick off the summer. It's not necessarily like our Camp Rad strangeness, but it's certainly pointing in the direction of where we want to go. We just want to take you around the world.
Yeah.
To hear some of these stories that you may have heard before or certainly, hopefully, have never heard before.
Yeah, those are the ones we really like. And speaking of stories that we've never heard of mm-hmm. that we would like to hear, if you would like to leave your story or your local urban legend or perhaps your own personal paranormal encounter, head on over to thatwouldberadpodcast.com where you can leave your voice memo directly onto the site and we can take that and we can put it in a future episode. If you're not really down with that and you would rather send it in like a email form, head on over to thatwouldberadpod@gmail.com. If you just want to drop us a line and say, hey, this is what I'm into, you guys are terrible, or we like mm-hmm. you guys, why haven't you covered this? Head on over to our Instagram. Jump in the comments. We want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. But going back to our website, you can jump on any podcatcher. You can go and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps. And if you haven't done it yet and you're a fan, you should be ashamed of yourself because it gets those extra ears, you know, on the show. If you're not getting enough of this free feed, head on over to our Patreon, The Rabbit Trail. We're really proud of it. And we have a lot of cool things planned, especially for the summer. And we'd love to have you over there. Is there anything else, Woody?
Well, just don't forget that the first episode, Camp Rad Strangeness, is coming in full force June 19th. So mm-hmm. we'll see you there.
Yeah. So bring that sunscreen. Get those mm-hmm. Inoculations. And don't forget that my birthday is 2 days after that. So
most
keep it in your mind. We love you. We appreciate you. And as always,
be rad.
That's the way it goes. Some sunshine, you were already dead for you to
became a ghost. You always said our future would be a parade of flowers, but now all that's left is a single rose. That's the way.
Granted.
They're the ones that provided like the raw material to support shipbuilding for the Navy in the Navy.
Since then, in the what?
1828.
No, but you said what it was the last thing you said?
It was established to provide raw material to support shipbuilding for the Navy in the area.
Oh, I thought you said in the navies.
Like yeah.
Like 80s.
In the navies.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, man, haven't seen you in a long time. What are you doing lately? I'm in the navies. Let's see.
Cut all that out.
Yeah, for sure.